This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Berling. Coming up, China. Its phenomenal growth is causing environmental problems that can engulf the entire planet. Secretary Babbitt takes 29 plants and animals off the endangered species list. Does this mean the Endangered Species Act is working? Tramp artists create works that are found in the Vatican and Smithsonian museums. They recycle scrap materials and renew themselves. 3 to 6 million Mexican free-tailed bats are arriving in Texas to give birth. Wow. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show. I'm Peter Berling. In coming weeks, President Clinton is scheduled to visit China. The White House staff is not prepared to discuss the agenda, but China's environmental problems are of major significance, not only to the Chinese, but to the entire globe. With 1.2 billion people and an expanding economy, China will produce more energy and more greenhouse gas emissions. This could nullify any progress the rest of the world makes in coping with climate change through the Kyoto Agreement. If China goes to global markets to meet its increasing demands for grain, worldwide shortages could be intense. Patrick Tyler, who has recently returned from Beijing, where he was bureau chief for the New York Times, says the apparent economic growth in China is environmentally unsustainable.
I think at the outset that one has to look at one of the great realities of China that not well perceived in the West. I think we look at China today and we see the building cranes of Shanghai, the new glimmering buildings of Beijing. We see an enormous amount of growth coming out of the ground. What you don't see is the degradation of a natural environment that has been carrying a load beyond its capacity. What you don't see is that as the millions, tens of millions of farmers have come in off the land to take urban jobs, that the farming that gets done now is less efficient. The organic material in the soil bases is going down because people aren't using manures and regenerating the soil. And there's got to be a hump in the curve out there on whether China's natural resource base can service this 1.6 billion population that is going to be there in 2025. China has to grow enormously rapidly just to service the 400 million additional Chinese that are going to be added to the population over the next 30 years. That's a big issue.
According to Brian Hallwyl, who has just co-authored a study for the World Watch Institute, water is a looming environmental crisis. Water is needed both for food production as well as municipal and industrial use.
The current demands that are being put on China's water supply are not sustainable. We can imagine them diverting increasing amounts away from agriculture, which would tax the world food supply. But at the same time, these diversions aren't satisfying the demands of China's cities and industry. Roughly half of China's cities are water short. This is about 300 out of China's 617 cities. And one of these cities that's largely water short is Beijing, which is China's capital. It's a mega city. It's got roughly 13 million people living there. And they're currently pumping groundwater below the city of Beijing at twice the rate of recharge.
Hallwyl says 70% of China's agricultural production comes from irrigated fields. But in this period of intense economic growth, he sees China's agricultural resource base crumbling as more and more water is diverted away from agriculture to more profitable industrial uses. Hallwyl says United States National Intelligence Committee, using its vast collection of satellite data, has conducted its own assessment of China's water and agricultural problems.
The National Intelligence Council, after completing this comprehensive study, came to roughly the same conclusions that World Watch did, that in the year 2025, unless steps are taken, China would have to import roughly 175 million tons of grain. Now, to put that number in perspective, current world exportable supplies are 200 million metric tons. So 175 million metric tons of imports for China would overwhelm world grain supplies.
The ripple effect of massive Chinese grain purchases on the world market is predicted to cause significant price increases. This could help American farmers, but could devastate a lot of poor countries like Pakistan, Egypt, Mexico, India, and Ethiopia that are having trouble paying for the grain imports they require today to feed their populations. Based on his experience in Beijing, Patrick Tyler says some Chinese officials are ready to think about environmental problems, but not ready to pay the costs of cleanup.
I think there is a genuine debate going on in the Chinese leadership about whether the degradation, the ongoing degradation of the Chinese environment is a limitation on national development. Is it a cost that has to be paid now on an ongoing basis as they develop, or can it be deferred in the future? I think as more water supplies get poisoned by fertilizers, groundwater aquifers diminish, fertilizer runoff spoils streams, crazy growth, tanning factories are put up on rivers and put effluents into the rivers that kill fish and ruin the aquatic industry, that the Chinese are recognizing they have to do something on an ongoing basis. The question is how to fund it.
Tyler says when it comes to cleaning up the environment, Chinese officials voice interest, as they did at the United Nations Conference on the Environment and Development in Rio in 1992. But if cleanup helps the world community, the Chinese say the United States and the developed world should pay for it.
Since Rio, I think China has essentially wanted it both ways. They've wanted, on the one hand, in the aftermath of Rio, to show that they were among the most scrupulous of nations, complying with the paperwork requirements of Rio and the large statements of commitment. Then as it comes down to a practical matter, China's position is very fundamental. It is saying to the developed West, the industrialized nations, you had your period of development, no one put restrictions on you. Our period of development is coming now. No one is going to hold us back. If you would like to finance environmental cleanup in our country as we develop, our hand is out, but please don't get in our way.
It appears, then, that if President Clinton does encourage the Chinese to protect the global environment during his visit, he may find a receptive audience, but only if his exhortation is coupled with cash. I'm Peter Burley. The bald eagle has made a comeback. That's the message from Interior Secretary Bruce Bamett. He recently announced the upgrading of the status of our national emblem and 28 other plant and animal species currently on the endangered species list. Peregrine falcons, eastern gray wolves, and brown pelicans are also on their way to being removed from the list. Secretary Babbitt says the recovery of these species shows that the Endangered Species Act works. Jim Waldman, director of Wildlife and Refuges Program with the Wilderness Society, agrees and says it shows the American public is getting its money's worth.
There have been a lot of myths spread about the Endangered Species Act. Perhaps the most outrageous one is that this act doesn't work, that in fact it's not saving fish and wildlife. I would say I'm uncomfortable with the notion that the only sign that the act is working or not working is how many species are recovering. Because the fact of the matter is that the Endangered Species Act is slowing and stopping further extinctions of species in this country. And that's an important measure of success right there. We can't expect for species that in some cases it took us decades or centuries to drive them to the point of extinction to recover in a few years or a few decades.
Waldman called Secretary Babbitt's announcement to remove such a large number of species from the list at one time unprecedented. Meanwhile, advocates for industry and private landowners are cautiously optimistic. Nancy McCann McNally, executive director of the National Endangered Species Act Reform Coalition, which is an industry group, says while the downlisting of the species is a positive sign, more needs to be done.
I don't think that it is a across-the-board mandate that the Endangered Species Act is a successful law. It still have to keep in mind that it's been on the books for some 25 years now, and of the number of species that have been listed, a very small percentage, even given these 29 to 30 that will be delisted or downlisted, not actually come off the list, is a small percentage. I think it's a sign that things are improving in some areas, and we take that as a positive sign, but there are still many aspects of the Endangered Species Act that we believe could work far better than they're working now.
Some say Secretary Babbitt's announcement to downlist species is an attempt to calm critics in the Congress. Critics say the Endangered Species Act is a one-way street, where species are added to the list but not removed once they've recovered. The federal threatened and endangered species list includes some 460 animal species and 660 plants. Currently, there are two bills that would reauthorize the Endangered Species Act before Congress, a reauthorization that's overdue. Most environmentalists are supporting California Representative George Miller's bill and opposing a measure submitted by Idaho Senator Dick Kempthorne. While there are a small number of environmentalists and a few newspapers supporting Kempthorne's legislation, most believe it would roll back protection of species that are in trouble and give more leverage to landowner and industry groups. These groups believe state and local officials need more information and a greater say in what happens to areas with endangered plants and animals, something the Kempthorne bill provides. Again, Nancy McCann McNally.
I believe the process needs to be opened up more to the public. It's a law that affects the public a great deal once a species is listed, affects the use of water and land resources, and so we support provisions in the legislation that's currently pending that would open up the process to the public through more hearings in rural areas, greater notice, greater information about restrictions that apply if you have a species on your land. Also believe that one of the areas that the legislation addresses that is something that is greatly needed is increasing incentives for landowners to conserve species on their land. The way in which the act is currently structured creates a lot of disincentives.
McCann McNally adds that landowners need to be better informed about endangered species and how a recovery plan affects them. The Wilderness Society's Jim Waltman agrees that property owners need more information, but doesn't believe the Kempthorne bill would help solve the problem of declining species populations. He says agencies like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service would be better able to manage trouble species if they had the resources to do so.
We spend about a quarter for every American a year on the Endangered Species Act. So, you know, you can't even make one phone call with that anymore. And when we've got more than 1,000 species that are in trouble, like we do, quite often species get very little in the way of monitoring or land acquisition or any of the other activities that they need to recover. So we've been pressing Congress very hard, and unfortunately it's been a struggling battle and often a losing battle to get a little bit more funding for the act.
There are some moderate Republicans who agree with Jim Waltman that more needs to be spent to give many species a fighting chance. Whether those programs actually receive the money, however, remains to be seen. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. If you have thoughts about the Chinese environment or the environment anyplace else, give us a call. Our comment line number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Email is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Thank you. We have a lot coming up on future environment shows, from aquaculture on an Indian reservation to the National Guard putting out forest fires. But now, an unusual look at recycling. From mayonnaise jars to newspapers and soup cans, more and more Americans are recycling to help the environment. For years, though, artists have been doing their part, some by shaping scrap metal into creative sculptures, and others by carving old wood into beautiful pieces of folk art. In fact, folk art is becoming a popular collectible. In upstate New York, there's a group of folk artists that's not only renewing wood, but renewing their lives in the process. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott prepared this report.
This is about the third step on this wood here. We take those crates like that, and we bring them in, we break them down, we cut them up, we bind them, and we have a film on it.
That's Michael Lavery, a founding member of the Hermitage Artists, describing how the craftsmen get their wood. Working out of an old house in Troy, New York, the carvers scour streets and alleys looking for pieces of scrap wood. They are useless materials to those who have thrown them away, but to Paul Cunningham, one of the easygoing, soft-spoken artists, they are building blocks to impressive pieces of folk art.
We started out just getting whatever wood that we could get, especially when the cigar boxes started to run low. We realized that we were going to have to change to another material, which the hobos readily used any material that they could find in the town dumps, which was known as hobo villages, hobo jungles. But our particular type of wood that we use is vegetable crates, mostly grape crates and pear boxes of various kinds of pine wood or maple wood. That seems to be the best type of material that we can use.
The artists oftentimes obtain high-quality woods in their travels, such as black walnut, oak, mahogany, and cedar, from homes that are being gutted, renovated, or torn down. They're also recycling about 6,000 wooden crates a year, crates that most likely would have ended up in a landfill. What was once garbage now becomes decorative containers of all shapes and sizes, picture frames, ornate desks, and beautiful sculptures. Paul says it's a special type of folk art the Hermitage artists practice.
It's a series of notches that are built up, notches on more notches, which form little pyramids, and whole rows of little pyramids that form big pyramids of little pyramids. And that is the particular style that is what is known as tramp art.
Tramp art rose out of the ashes of the Civil War. As hobos or homeward bounds traveled home or to find work, many took up scrap pieces of wood to whittle or notch. Notching reappeared in the 1930s when the Depression sent many adrift looking for work. These drifters of the railways also notched wood into sculpture. To this day, many consider these train hoppers as society's outcasts, and perhaps in some respects they are. But they too have a role in Americana, according to Michael Lavery.
They recycled there, and they lived in dumps. They built, you know, like Hooverville's type shanties out of whatever they found in the dumps. And they recycled everything. Their pots and pans were paint cans. They used whatever they had. And basically, they were an asset to the community.
In many respects, though, the lives of these four men represents the struggle of the hobo, because they, too, were once drifters, seemingly hopeless cases in the grips of drug and alcohol addiction. But with their craft and support from each other, they have been able to accumulate dozens of years of sobriety between them. Jim Kennedy, the group's patriarch, explains the origin of the Hermitage name.
I was reading a book on the life of St. Francis and what he wrote about his Hermitage and the men in it. And he told them, if you work at your craft, you'll become a brotherhood. You'll find out you need each other and you'll gain sustenance. And he also told him, I'll give you someone to guard you from diversity. So it's safe for an artist. That's what I was thinking. Wow, what a thing. We can each work separately, but together. And what it is, if Michael's working on a big piece, the pieces are being cut by Paul, notched by Andy. I might be polishing or cutting stars for the boxes or whatever it may be. And people come in and say to us, the real amazing thing in here is the sense of community.
The story of the Hermitage artists reads like a fairy tale, truly a rags-to-riches story. Today, pieces of their art appear in the Vatican and the Smithsonian Museum. They have a contract with Neiman Marcus and other retail outlets and have worked with the Discovery Channel on several projects. More importantly, these recovering artists continue to help other alcoholics and addicts by oftentimes offering them a place to go when all the doors close. Their message is one of hope, not only for the environment, but for freedom from personal bondage. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we broadcast, Mexican free-tailed bats are migrating from Mexico to Texas to give birth. Each year, some 3 to 6 million bats take over the Eckert James River Bat Cave Preserve in Mason, Texas, outside of Austin. When they descend into the cave, they create a dark plume that looks almost like a tornado. The preserve, which is owned by the Nature Conservancy, is about 12 acres in size, and the cave is about the size of a 3-bedroom house. Brian Keeley is staff biologist for Bat Conservation International, which co-manages the preserve. He says gestation is about 11 weeks, and says the babies are bald, pink, and about the size of a quarter when they emerge.
When the mothers give birth to the young, they place them together within the cave so that if you look into the cave, all the mothers will be roosting on one portion. There'll be a big, dark, brown, chocolate patch where the mothers are, and all the babies will be roosting in another area referred to as a creche, and it's a big pink patch on the wall. So there'll be, and this will happen throughout the cave, so you'll see pink patches and dark patches throughout the cave on the walls and ceilings.
At birth, baby Mexican free-tailed bats weigh about 3 grams, which is quite large considering adults are only 3 times that weight. Adults have a wingspread of about 1 foot, and they occasionally have white patches on their mainly dark brown bodies. Brian Keeley says the name of this species refers to a very unique characteristic.
They're called the Mexican free-tailed bat because the tail on the bat extends out like a little mouse tail, which is kind of unusual among bats. Usually the tail membranes that they use in flight extend to the tip of the tail and you don't see the tail. But on these bats you can, and so it has a free tail. And say they weigh about 12 grams. They're relatively, I guess, mid-sized bat for North American bat.
Mexican free-tailed bats are very social creatures. They have to be, considering 300 bats can be found in a square foot area of the cave. Besides caves, the bats can be found roosting beneath bridges or in buildings, talking among themselves. Brian Keeley says it's quite a sight to see hundreds of thousands of bats emerge from a cave at one time, especially during the afternoon hours when the bats head toward crop areas to feed on a lot of bugs.
We've calculated that if there's 3 million bats in this colony, and that's a conservative estimate, that they're consuming from 20 to 30 tons of insects each night. And we know they're moth specialists, meaning that they tend to prefer moths to other food items. They forage at high altitudes. Some of the studies that are going on are indicating that some of the most major pest species in North America migrate at high altitudes. These moths come in from Mexico every year, and they move up. It's the corn earworm or cotton bollworm moth, and they migrate up from Mexico, and the Mexican free-tailed bats come out, and Doppler weather radar, you can actually see them on the radar. They come out in such dense colonies, will rise up to these areas where these moths are migrating. So kind of like Scud missiles, we think that they're intercepting these migrations of insect pests.
One of the most fascinating characteristics of bats is their use of echolocation. Experts believe a mother bat is able to find her pup in a cave of millions by using a combination of sound and scent. There are no lost kid tags or wrist leashes for these mothers. And since they don't lose their babies, they don't even go bats. You're listening to The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a group called Northwest Environmental Watch says we should tax pollution instead of income. We talk green about fuel cells with a manufacturer who's making a machine for your basement that should make all the electricity your house will need. And author Ann Eales takes us to the Arizona Territory, where the environment was tough on soldiers and their wives. Stay with us.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, keeping an eye on the Northwest. The Pacific Northwest is a single biological region, the place where water flows to the Pacific through the greatest temperate rainforests on the planet. The region stretches from southeast Alaska to northwestern California, and from the ocean to the crest of the Rocky Mountains. It's home to 13 million people and to the Seattle-based not-for-profit research center Northwest Environment Watch, or NEW. NEW, according to Executive Director Alan Durning, is a spin-off of the renowned World Watch Institute. Like the World Watch Institute, he says, NEW focuses on economic and environmental sustainability. But instead of focusing on worldwide issues, its focus is on the Northwest. Durning says NEW synthesizes up-to-date facts from the natural and social sciences and hard-learned lessons into no-nonsense books. These books are then distributed to Northwestern policymakers, elected officials, nonprofit organizations, educators, and citizens.
Last year, 1997, we released a book about climate change and its impacts on the Northwest region and what we could do about it, before which we released book on population growth in North America, particularly in the Northwest, and ways that we could slow it while at the same time sustaining people and their communities. Before that, we released a book called Stuff, The Secret Lives of Everyday Things, that describe the global production systems and the environmental consequences of creating a cup of coffee, a newspaper, and nine other everyday consumer goods. This book, maybe more than most of our others, has caught on around the country and, in fact, around the world as a way to help people think about their relationship to the globe. We've done books in the past about cars and transportation in cities, about the ecological health of our watersheds, and about ways that government policy subsidize environmentally destructive activities.
Their most recent publication is called Tax Shift, Not the usual bread and butter subject for an environmental research center, but Durning believes reforms to our tax system provide an enormous opportunity for improving environmental quality and economic performance at the same time.
We mostly tax the wrong things in our country. We tax things we want more of, such as paychecks and businesses, rather than things we want less of, such as pollution and resource depletion. Tax Shift, our new book, argues that we should tax pollution before taxing paychecks. And it points out that if we were to do so, we would end up with a cleaner world and healthier bank balances. It's a win-win for the economy and the environment.
Tax Shift, Durning explains, is a first-ever analysis of how an environmental tax shift would affect the Northwest states and British Columbia. Already adopted by six European nations, Durning argues that the Northwest is a ripe testing ground for tax shifting in the United States. He says the Northwest is the most ecologically intact part of the industrial world, with a long history of innovativeness in public policy and strong environmental consciousness. He believes the region's economy, because it is not greatly tied to heavy manufacturing industries, would have an easier time and fewer political opponents to creating, for example, pollution taxes.
We could tax pollutants that come out of factory smokestacks. These pollutants are already regulated by federal and state authorities. Their quantities are already monitored, and in fact, small regulatory fees are already imposed. We could gradually increase the fees and use the revenue to offset existing taxes on income or retail sales or businesses. Just so, we could put fees on pollution from tailpipes of automobiles. In all of the major cities of the U.S., cars are required to have their emissions inspected every other year, and at those inspections, you could be charged a small tax based on how much your car polluted. In the Northwest, we figured it would be about $135 per car per year on average, but some cars would pay much more, others would pay much less.
Northeast Environment Watch believes time is short and priorities are ill-defined. For their part, Durning says they're trying to make a roadmap to help foster a sustainable way of life for the Pacific Northwest. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today, we're going to be discussing fuel cells and your home. Fuel cells are machines that make electricity using hydrogen, and they convert chemical energy into electricity without combustion. Emissions from fuel cells are virtually negligible, so they are, for all practical purposes, free of pollution. And they're also pretty efficient because they convert more than 60% of the energy they use into electricity, whereas a conventional power generator does it at about 35%. It's also not an idea that's new. Fuel cells powered the Gemini spacecraft almost two decades ago, and they were known even before that. But the thing that is new is the idea that you might be able to buy a fuel cell and put it in your basement, generate your own power, and unplug yourself from the grid. So if you have questions or comments, give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. I have three guests with me today. Bill Acker, he is Vice President of Plug Power Incorporated. That's a company in Latham, New York, that's designing fuel cells for home use. And they expect to have a prototype out next month. And he's with me here in the studio. Also with us is Jack Brower. He is Associate Director of the National Fuel Cell Research Center at the University of California in Irvine. He joins us from California. And also with us is Nathaniel Green. He's an energy policy analyst from the Natural Resources Defense Council. That's an environmental organization. And he's been following the development and emergence of fuel cell technology for some time. So, Bill, welcome here in the studio. Let's start with you. This prototype fuel cell that you hope to have ready in a month, what is it going to do?
Well, Peter, fuel cells, as you said, are a clean, efficient way of making electricity.
they will really revolutionize the electricity generation industry. What this device will do will allow the electricity to be made on site in a person's home in a very high efficiency, low cost method. So what we will have is a device that will be about the size of a small dishwasher that will sit in someone's basement or could be sited next to their house like a central air conditioning unit that will make the electricity for the home.
Well, nothing is free. What runs the thing if I get one of your gadgets and stick it in my basement or next to my dishwasher?
There are a couple of fuels that can be used. The main design is for natural gas fueling, and so these would be incorporated in homes that have natural gas coming into the home. The device converts the natural gas and makes electricity in a chemical method as opposed to a combustion method.
Well, Jack Brower from the National Fuel Cell Research Center, let me ask you, is this a technology as you see it that really is applicable to widespread use throughout the country?
Yes, it certainly is, in particular because of its natural gas operating capability. It could be widely applied if it can meet some of the cost targets so that it becomes affordable for the average consumer.
And when you talk about cost targets, are you thinking about the cost of the unit or the cost of the fuel or both?
Well, it's particularly the capital cost. Fuel cells will produce electricity much more efficiently than other power generation devices, so they'll save the consumer money with regard to fuel costs or energy costs. But the capital cost at this time is a little bit higher than one would like to have, such that the rate of return doesn't come at a rate that is acceptable to most consumers.
Well, before we get to Nat Green from NRDC, Bill, your gadget, how much do you think it's going to sell for?
Well, I would like to address that issue because one thing that we're very excited about is that people have been talking about fuel cells for years. As you said, the fuel cell concept has been around for a long time. The prices of the fuel cells have been coming down dramatically over the past few years with R&D and product development that's been occurring. So we are expecting to have a unit that will be placed in someone's home that will actually reduce the cost of electricity in operation when you count the capital costs in there. And a reduction will be on the order of about 20% off of their present electricity bill.
And again, just to kind of get a sense of it, when you start marketing these things, and I realize that's still a couple years off, how much will I have to spend to buy one?
Well, there are a couple of ways that that may be done. It may be that people will actually lay out the money up front to purchase the fuel cell. But another way to do that is that the cost of the fuel cell is built into the price of the electricity so that people are not having to front that capital cost themselves. That may be much more attractive to the consumer.
So just so we understand what that means, I would sign up for one of your machines and I would pay you or somebody for the electricity. I wouldn't pay for the machine and presumably I would pay less for the electricity than I would if I got it off the grid.
That's exactly right. You would have more reliable, cheaper electricity, and again, have the benefit for the environment.
And again, just before we go on, if I did want to buy it, and I realize this is still speculative, about how much do you think these things are going to sell for?
We don't have a target price.
You won't sell me one yet. Okay, Nat Green from NRDC. You've been looking at the energy business for some time. Is this a monumental breakthrough, or is this just another techno gizmo that is out there?
I wouldn't say it's a monumental breakthrough. I think it's part of a ongoing transition that's been going on in the energy industry. Since really the late 70s, a movement towards cleaner and more efficient technologies. And I think fuel cells, have a hugely important role to play in that movement towards a cleaner technology, in that even running off a fossil fuel like natural gas, they produce substantial air pollution benefits, reductions. And they clearly are part of a package of clean technologies that we in the environmental community and certainly here at NRDC are very excited about. And I think the really important thing for people to realize is that, there are a lot of these technologies, including fuel cells now, larger than residential scale fuel cells, but fuel cells nonetheless that are available today, are commercially available. And if used in the right for the right applications can be saving people money today.
Right, right. Jack, from University of California, let me ask you about fuel. We've been talking about a fuel cell designed for home use that will start burning natural gas, but of course that's just the source of hydrogen. As we look out, are we going to be seeing greater conversions to other forms of fuel that are perhaps not conventionally known now? Do we get to a hydrogen economy through this?
Well, I think the fuel cell can play an instrumental role in the conversion from a fossil fuel-based economy to a renewable fuel-based economy, one that could use hydrogen as the energy carrier. And that's a long-term plan that people have, or a goal that people have, so that we can eventually relieve ourselves of the dependence on fossil fuels and provide a clean energy carrier in the form of hydrogen.
Well, as you look at the development of a fuel cell, as Bill is talking about it, residential use and so on, do you see natural gas as the favored fuel over a long period of time, or is this transitional before we move into something else?
Well, I think as long as natural gas is readily available, and as long as it is has a reasonable abundance in and can be supplied at a reasonable cost to consumers, it will be one of the fuels of choice. Eventually, as natural gas supplies dwindle and as energy prices or natural gas prices increase, there will be more of a an economic push towards other fuels.
Well, Bill, from Plug Power, you're talking about a gadget that will be running on natural gas that I can put in my house. A lot of us don't live near gas lines. Does that mean that the home fuel cell is restricted to a market of people that happen to live and have natural gas pumped into the bottom of their house?
No, that's a real good point, Peter. And I should hasten to add that we are designing the fuel cell system to work with a number of different fuels. The market is huge for the natural gas market right off the bat. It's a $100 billion market worldwide, very exciting for us and very exciting for its benefits. But clearly there are other fuels that can be used. Propane could be used, methanol could be used, a lot of other fuels could be used that are more transportable than natural gas. So for more remote applications where you don't have an infrastructure, you may want to use more of these transportable fuels, and we are concurrently developing those products.
And I would assume that for a lot of people, being off the grid is more attractive if you live out in the country, as we do, because when the storm hits or whatever, it's the folks in town that get the power first.
That's right. Also, it's more attractive for the utility companies in that they would like to have other ways of supplying power for more remote applications. So it's a win for everybody.
Nat Green, you've been looking at this on a national level. Do we see a country developing in which nobody's on the grid as time goes on, and all of our home generation is from local units, either owned by the homeowner or a block association or something like that?
Yeah, I think that's quite a ways off. The investment we've made in the electric grid is substantial, and it does provide a lot of benefits in terms of reliability to large numbers of people. What I see is a definite shift towards increased small-scale and distributed generation, such as fuel cells, that will allow, will even increase the reliability of the grid and allow us to avoid making huge investments in transmission lines. So it's more of a shift, as we've seen in the computer industry, even from large central computers to network computers, where if you lose your network, you don't have to stop working. You can keep using your PC on your desk, but you still use a network for the benefits that provides you.
And when the thing crashes and you lose all your memory, only you go crazy, not the guy that's sitting at the desk next to you.
Yeah, well, there's benefits both ways.
Jack Brower, what kind of research are you folks engaged in? What are some of the critical points that you're trying to deal with as in your research center?
Well, one of the main issues with regard to fuel cells is to try to reduce the capital cost of fuel cells.
And that's to make them cheaper for the people who buy them, I guess.
Right, so that we can sell them to consumers and have them actually produce energy at higher efficiencies and with lower emissions and actually reap the benefits of fuel cell technology.
Do you need to get some breakthroughs to cut down costs, or is that just a question of...
Well, as was pointed out earlier by Bill Acker, there have been some very substantial breakthroughs that have occurred over the last 10 years that have reduced the capital cost substantially. And that's what's making the fuel cell community very excited about actually applying the technology and actually having it obtain widespread use in the market. Other issues that need to be addressed include fuel flexibility issues, and Bill pointed that out as well in his description of developing technologies for propane, for methanol, and other fuels that can be used for fuel cells to make the fuel cell more applicable to the mass market.
Bill, we've touched on this, but from your perspective, when do you think there are going to be enough of these around so it really is readily available? It's a real choice for all of us as opposed to a few who may want to spend more to get on the cutting edge of technology.
Well, Plug Power's plan for commercialization is that we will have product out available in the year 2000. And that, of course, is an introduction. And I like the analogy of the personal computer to the mainframe. It takes years for these things to fully penetrate the market. But in fact, you will start to see them in the year 2000. And over the next few years, you will start to see, a fairly rapid penetration. So look for them shortly in the next century.
And presumably, a lot of people are going to be making them as time goes on. Is that a fair guess?
I would expect, obviously, there will be more than one company involved in this field. The number that will actually shake out in the end is hard to say at this point, but it's a huge field.
And it does not then require further technological breakthrough. Now it's a question of just making them so they work. Is that fair?
It's a question of engineering and design and getting the product to market, and that's what we're focusing on. Our company has grown from 20 people to over 100 people, and Plug Power is really committed to getting these things out in the very short term.
Okay. Well, we've been discussing fuel cells in your home. I'm afraid our time is up. My guests have been Bill Acker from Plug Power, which is in the process of making some, Jack Brower from the National Fuel Cell Research Center at the University of California, and Nathaniel Green from the environmental group, the Natural Resources Defense Council. We've been talking green. We'd like to hear your comments. Give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN. And as I said, we've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can listen to The Environment Show anytime on your personal computer. It's www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. Look us up. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Ann Eales, the Arizona Territory was a harsh environment for wives of soldiers in the American Expeditionary Force. In this portrait of place, Eales reads from her book titled Army Wives on the American Frontier, Living by the Bugles.
Before they went west, Army wives had undoubtedly read articles, or railroad promotional material, that described the active outdoor life on the frontier as healthy and invigorating. Many of the women wrote how they looked forward to raising their children in clean, crisp air and wide open spaces, far from the epidemics that periodically spread from the slums of overpopulated eastern cities. However, the women quickly discovered that the benefits of life in this pristine environment were sometimes counteracted by disease caused by the military's marginal diet, substandard living conditions, and lack of adequate medical care. In 1890, there were only 147 military doctors west of the Mississippi to care for more than 20,000 soldiers and the entire population of military dependents and government civilians. When these medical men were away for long periods of time, on patrols or expeditions with the troops, it was up to Army wives to provide medical care for themselves and their families. They studied cure-alls listed in popular health journals of the period. They rubbed chloroform on toothaches, applied gunpowder to warts, and used turpentine on snake bites, with a lump of sugar to treat a sore throat, or to rub on hemorrhoids, an affliction that caused severe problems for people who were frequently in the saddle. The wives also learned about new medications and techniques from Native Americans, who eventually introduced 59 valuable drugs to medical science. Wads of cobwebs, readily available at frontier posts, could be stuffed into wounds to stop bleeding. Poultices of cooked onions were spread on bronchitis sufferers, and garlic tea was used to treat rheumatism. When Alice Baldwin's baby daughter Juanita was teething, an Indian medicine man went outside and gathered some rattlesnake rattles. Shaking them and chanting softly, he quickly put the child to sleep. George Armstrong Custer's servant presented the mother of a new baby with the vertebrae of a rattlesnake he had just killed, because he had heard that it was good for a teething child to chew on. In the West, Army families lived with the immediacy of disease and death, as fathers and friends who left for work in the morning sometimes didn't come home at night. When military wife Kitty Gibson became lonely during the long winter months at Fort Rice in Dakota Territory, she would take out her family album and look at pictures of her loved ones who were far away in the East. One day when she was doing so, two children from the garrison came for a visit. Examining the photographs, the children were struck by a picture of an elderly man and asked Kitty who it was and where he was. She replied that it was her father, and he was dead. The little boy asked, "Who killed him?" Kitty considered it a reasonable question, for no one died a natural death out there, but was either killed by Indians, or in barroom brawls, or frozen to death. When Kitty responded that no one had killed him, the children were puzzled by the novel idea that someone could actually die of old age. The little girl finally realized, "Nobody killed him. He just died his own self." In a land where the post cemetery at Camp Date Creek in Arizona Territory in 1869 had not one occupant over 23 years of age, none of whom had died a natural death, the children's confusion is easily understood. The Western boy and girl looking at the picture of Katie's elderly father seldom had met civilians, rarely had seen an old person, and never, never had experienced a death that did not come without disease or violence.
That was author Ann Eales reading from her book titled Army Wives on the American Frontier, Living by the Bugles. It's published by Johnson Books. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Before you pay your next electric bill, get a copy of the show and think about a fuel cell. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and order show number 437. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.